The shift in landscape is inevitable, especially when you live on a fault line like many of us on the West Coast do. A recent report from the U.S. Geological Survey found that California's earthquake map extends over a wider area than previously thought, raising hazard estimates for places like San Jose and Vallejo, while reducing estimates in Oakland. What life in the Bay Area would be like after a major earthquake and how prepared we are to cope with it is something on many people's minds. I sat down with journalist Ethan Waters to talk about his essay Shaken, which explores what might happen after the next big one hits the Bay.
So the imaginary account that I create is basically based on the 06 quake. It's an 8.0, very close to San Francisco. Of course, San Francisco is a lot different now than it used to be. There's housing where there wasn't. So the consequences of that quake are remarkably different. But it's basically an 8.0, which is pretty much the worst case scenario for San Francisco.
How did you research this story?
So I went to the city. So I went to the people that will be in charge the moments after the quake. So I went and visited the director of this place along Turk Street where we have our 911 center, and they have a set of tables in a big room ready for this event, and the tables are all for different departments of the city, and that will be like the trading floor that everyone will go to, the mayor and all the heads of those agencies.
And I'm assuming this is like a total earthquake safe
yes,
building.
It's the black box of earthquake safety.
So
this building could take a lot of shaking, and it's also the one with all the amazing amount of technology, site maps that can be put on the wall, and all the hard wiring, any wire that still exists, goes directly to that place in terms of communications, the place with ham radios and satellite communications and so forth. The mayor will go there. The main people in charge of the city services will go there. And they'll do that because they need to coordinate their activities. So if a fire truck can't get to a place because a tree is down, they'll be able to coordinate with the people that can take the tree out and so forth. It's a remarkable amount of coordination. They often run these drills basically to try to be ready for this quake. Of course, an earthquake like a war is so unpredictable. You don't know where the fires are going to start. One of the things the city does, which I found sort of interesting, is after a really major disaster like an 8.0, of course, all these calls start flooding into the 911 center, and they'll immediately stop sending out responders for a period of time, not a very long time, but they need to know, they need to have a plan, because if they begin to send responders out to the first calls that come in, of course, your resources will be gone just almost instantly.
So you need a sort of triage system.
Absolutely. You need to really get in front of the major disasters, which, I have to say, leaves you and, the rescue of your pet, or maybe even the rescue of someone in your family or your neighbor, oftentimes leaves you alone. The people that studies disasters, discover that 90% and upwards of the rescues that happen after a major disaster happen by civilians. And the thing I learned as I did the research about what happens after those things that is really kind of hopeful is that people react remarkably well in this situation as a general rule. There's a myth about people sort of losing their minds and stampeding and doing horrible things And it turns out that the people that really study these things, that have looked at major disasters that have happened around the world, all come to the same conclusion, which is that people are in some ways, our minds are bred for disaster. We can handle it. And the things that people do for each other after that moment, particularly in the first few days, first hours and first few days, are really remarkable. And you can really depend on the people that are out there to help you out. And that's... it's interesting that myth exists. I think, it often gets created in the weeks after a disaster when the, TV crews and so forth come in and they're looking for bad behavior. They're looking for, the store that gets broken into or the person that behaves badly. And they tend to make that the story, and they tend to be on the lookout for that, as opposed to the tens of thousands of remarkably selfless acts that happen after a disaster.
That's local author Ethan Waters, and he's written this essay, Shaken, that you can read. We'll put a link to it at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. There's an interesting section on how the Bay Area is uniquely primed, perhaps, to survive the big one, thanks to the big event that happens yearly in the Black Rock Desert. So tell us why you think Burning Man might save us here.
Well, you know, I read a long time ago that there it was a book by Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone. He made the case that, you know, our generation was basically had lost its social capital. We don't join the League of Women Voters. We don't tend to have the social clubs and so forth that our parents had. And my belief is that he's absolutely wrong, that we have this social capital. It just tends to get sort of hidden in ways that it's hard for sociologists to sort of pinpoint and count. And certainly after the next 8.0 earthquake, all sorts of organizations and ways people are connected to each other will come out of the woodwork. So this could be anything from the neighborhood garden to, a immigrant community. All of those ways people are tied together will be put to the test. And I think one of the things that's going to happen will be that Burning Man cohort. And they will be of great use because they will have in their garages all the tarps and all the 5-gallon drums and all the things they haul out to the desert to live for a week, you know, in really formidable conditions. They have that all in San Francisco. There's a tremendous amount of that infrastructure, and there's also not a small amount of knowledge about how to, you know, set up a toilet, for instance, and do these basic things. And also this sort of sensibility of that no one's a observer, that you pitch in, that you share your food and so forth. I really do think that will be a positive factor. It may not be the key factor in terms of what happens in the next quake, but I think people will be relieved to find that the social ties that they have in San Francisco after that 8.0 earthquake will be very meaningful for them and really make the difference.
So if you've shaken one of us listening out of our complacency, what is one thing you would say we should be doing right now?
Well, certainly if you own property, you should have your property assessed. There are resources at the city of San Francisco that will help you understand, you know, the basic forms of earthquake mitigation, what you could do so that your house will not collapse. You should take that NERT training, the neighborhood emergency response training, because you're going to have to rely on your neighbors after this.
And they're going to have to rely on you. Yeah. They probably have not taken it.
And you can, I suppose there's a way in which you can, you know, be motivated by fear, but there's also a way in which you can remember that, you know, disasters do happen to humans around the world. There's no reason to think, since we live in a privileged, wealthy place, that we should be immune to them. There are remarkable things that happen after a disaster. Life does not stop after an 8.0 earthquake. In some ways, people will find it their lives really beginning, it will literally have shaken their lives into a different place. There's nothing to assume that place has to be a terrible one.